Live from the Allstate Showcase Studio, this is the Steve Cochran Show on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Well, look who's back. Good morning. The Steve Cochran Show for Thursday morning. Steve is away. Dave Bennett, Andrea Darlis, who is back after being away. How long were you in Greece?
Boy, I feel like I was there a very, very long time. We were actually there 10 days.
It feels that way to us, too.
Yeah, I know,
it's actually 2 weeks.
You know what's cool, though? Watching you guys one day, Wi-Fi was spotty in Santorini. We went to Athens, the mainland, Olympia. We went all through the mountains, the Peloponnese. Stunning, gorgeous, beautiful, wonderful time with all the WGN listeners. And the one day we got to Santorini, Wi-Fi was a little bit spotty in our resort. So when I went by the pool, I was actually able to get you guys on the stream and watch you. And that was
okay,
kind of time very
out.
Surreal.
Time out. You're sitting by a pool. You're watching us. What is wrong with you?
I couldn't get on the internet right away for a couple of days. So I was starting to shake. And I thought, well, I better go on and see what's new. And WGN Radio is the first thing that pops up on my phone.
Right.
And I saw you guys all on the stream.
Mm-hmm.
You guys were doing
well.
Did
it bring a tear to your eye?
It was right after the football picks, too. I thought, oh, I better not even listen to how poorly I did.
You wouldn't have enjoyed that.
No, not at all.
But you look great. I had a great time, huh?
I did miss you guys. Yeah, we had, like I said, we went all over the mainland in Athens and the Parthenon, the Acropolis, toured all through Delphi and Corinth, and it was just amazing.
I've always wanted to go to Santorini. It just looks beautiful.
It was magnificent. I had never been. I'd been to Athens. I'd been to Mykonos and Rhodes and Zakynthos, but I'd never been to Santorini, and it was spectacular. It's everything, you know, when you see the white villages and the churches with the blue domes, and I'm taking pictures, and I thought, none of this is even going to just transpire as to how beautiful of a place this is. And it's just relaxing and nice. And then, Mary, I think I sent you one of the pictures of the sunset in Santorini.
Oh, yeah.
It was just beautiful.
You posted a picture on Facebook. You're in a theater. Mm-hmm. You're on the top steps, and the steps go down to the center of this. It's like a theater in the round,
kind of like an
amphitheater.
It's an ancient theater that was in Corinth, and it was the oldest theater ever. It was the oldest theater in existence, and you can sit on the very, you saw how steep it was. You could sit at the very top, and the performers at the very bottom. The acoustics are amazing, and there was actually a woman down there, and she was dropping a coin. She dropped a coin, and you can hear ding. You know, it's just as loud as if you were sitting in the front row of this theater.
I was worried about you when I saw the picture. I'm like, a breeze could come up and knock you backwards.
And knock you back. That's where back in the day, that's where all the common folk sat. So I went up there to be with
mingle with your people.
Yeah, mingle with the common folk, my
people.
That was great. And all the aristocrats would sit down at the bottom. But the history is wonderful. We had great guides who just taught us all of the history and everything that. Well, pretty much everything that was invented in Greece, including modern democracy.
Right. And the food?
Oh, the food was excellent. Food, we had, of course, lamb and souvlaki and potatoes, and it was just an amazing
food. How would you compare the food you had to the food you would get, say, in Greektown?
I would say it's very, very, very similar, because most of the cooks in Greektown, most of the restaurant owners are from Greece. So they come over and they bring their yayas, their grandma's recipes.
Their yayas?
Their yaya. That's grandma. That's not code. Their yaya and their papu, their grandma and grandpa's recipes they bring over from the old country. But you would have loved the beaches, Carmen. They were stunning.
Really?
Yeah.
That's what that's how you're going to throw
Carmen,
it out there.
The sand.
The sand, huh? How do they take to those beaches? Is that an au naturel type of beach scene?
Many are. Yeah, you can choose to go au naturel. I did not.
Good for you, Andrea.
Did our WGN listeners?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I don't. No, we didn't. We left that to, you know,
be kind of awkward.
The young hottie tourists.
So there was some sightings of a Freeness out in. Is that possible?
Yeah, there was a couple of sightings. A couple of female sightings.
It's always exciting.
Au naturel.
Good for them.
But you would have loved the black sand beaches and the white sand beaches. I know. It was cool. This was cool. We went to a beach in Olympia, and I said, it's so nice, because I love our lakefront. I mean, I live on the lakefront. I think we have the most beautiful city in the world. But it was nice to actually go to the beach, and there's no rocks and no sand, no cigarette butts, rather, no beer bottles, no glass.
Was ABBA there?
That we went to a church, St. George's, in Athens, and it's the highest point in Athens, higher than the Parthenon, and we circled up and circled up and circled up, and at the top there was a little church going on, with a wedding, or there was a church with a wedding
like
going
Mama
on.
Mia?
Yeah, and everybody said, they were like, oh, where's Meryl Streep?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no.
Oh, Dean,
I hope Pierce Brosnan didn't
Dean
show up.
Richards, Dean would have loved that, because that's, I'm sure, I think that's one of his favorite movies, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, Mama Mia.
Do they do the afternoon siesta in Greece? Did you take like a nice like 2 to 4 nap? That's always been my dream.
Yeah, many of the stores do the siesta, you know, so they have store hours, and it says, we close Mondays from 1 to 2, Tuesdays from 2 to 3. You know, they just decide
so
at will when they're going to take
and
a siesta.
And then the clubs open at midnight? Is it like...
Yeah, the clubs do. Yeah, they eat dinner late. You know, 9 o'clock, 9:30, and then 10 o'clock. One of our guides said, yeah, so I'm going to go to this nightclub about 11:30, 12, if you guys want to. I'll go. And we went, yeah, okay.
Come on, Andre. You didn't go?
Are you
kidding? Your mom.
I'm falling asleep. Yo, my mom was great.
Yeah, she's like, let's go.
She had a great time. She was at one point, I looked behind, I thought, where is she? She was way ahead of me.
All right, here's the most important question.
Yes.
Was there golf?
There's no golf.
No golf?
No golf. There are only two courses.
Oh, I want to go there.
Just outside.
Me too.
Right. There's only two golf courses outside of Athens, so no golf.
I didn't realize that. So,
they're big into soccer.
Yeah, well, we know that.
How did you survive
without golf?
I don't know. 2 weeks. I think we're going to play this week, aren't we? You're going to have a huge advantage.
I think the weather is not real promising.
Nope.
The week is almost over, by the way.
It's supposed to rain the rest of the weekend.
Well, it was awesome. I missed you guys, and I have presents for everybody. And, yeah, again, huge thanks to Steve Bertrand and the listeners of WGN, who are fantastic. And I really mean it. They love you guys. They love what we're doing, and we thank them for being there. And Steve's next trip is to Iceland in June, so go to Steve Bertrand Travel to check it out. He plans a really nice trip.
Yeah, thanks, Bertrand.
Yeah. Might ask you to go to Iceland. Oh, wait, you got that little old thing called a wedding.
That might be a good time to go.
Right.
What to see, what's out at the show. I need to know the place and when. But there's one guy on GN's Cochrane Show, and what he says will make us stay or go. He is Nick at Night, DiGiulio. He knows what shows are good, what's stinking. He's the only one who's in the know. I need to know what Nick is thinking. I need to know what Nick is thinking.
And we're going to find out right now what Nick is thinking. Morning, Nick.
Good morning.
All right, so I've seen a lot of promotion for Masterminds. What a great cast they've got.
Yeah, it is a terrific cast. It's loosely based on a true story. Zach Galifianakis plays a guy who works for an armored truck company, drives the armored truck around, and decides that he wants to steal $17 million, and he gets a group of people together to do the heist, and then double crosses occur. The rest of the cast includes Owen Wilson, Kristen Wiig, Jason Sudeikis, Kate McKinnon, and Leslie Jones.
Oh, my God. All my favorites.
So it's front-loaded with really, really funny people.
Is that good or bad, though, Nick? Is that good or bad? Sometimes when you get
here's the bad thing about it. The movie's a year and a half old. It's been sitting on the shelf for over a year. It was supposed to come out last year. They delayed it. It was supposed to come out 6 months ago. They delayed it. It's not a good sign when a movie, especially with a cast like this, the guy who directed it directed a couple of funny movies, including Nacho Libre, and he directed Napoleon Dynamite, a movie I hate, but everybody else seems to love.
it's not like this
director doesn't have a pedigree, because he does. He's directed some popular movies, and you know, I just mentioned the cast. The cast is incredible, and they're all very funny people. So I hope it's just my only hesitation is the fact that it's old, that it's been sitting on the shelf, and they delayed the release. Outside of that, I hope it's funny, because I love everybody in it.
Nick, why do they do that? I mean, maybe that's a dumb question, but why do they film the movie, put it on the shelf, not to release it? I mean, they want to make money, obviously, but why not release it right away?
Well, if it's a movie that's in trouble, they'll either there are different reasons why they'll hold a movie and delay the release and convince the director to recut it or change it or go back and refilm it because it tests screenings. Well, the main reason why movies are delayed is because they test poorly, because the studio doesn't like them, because the preview audiences think it sucks. So they go back, they try to retool, they recut, they reshoot, or they just hold it on the shelf because they've got no great place to release it because they think it's going to tank. And this was scheduled to be released last Christmas, And they thought, nope, it's not a Christmas release. It's not going to do well. Then it was supposed to come out during the summer. Didn't come out during the summer. So, you know, late September is a very odd slot for this movie to come out. So, but there are a lot of things behind it. I mean, I'm assuming that this movie was probably recut or changed. It happens very, very often where a studio doesn't have confidence in a movie. They won't release it, and they'll make the director change it. It happens all the time.
Well, maybe we'll be pleasantly surprised by it.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope so.
Deepwater Horizon. That's Mark Wahlberg, right?
Yeah, Mark Wahlberg, based on a true story of one of the biggest man-made disasters of all time. It took place in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010, and a bunch of guys working on an oil rig in the middle of the ocean, and an explosion happens, and it's a total disaster. They're in the middle of, you know, they're in the middle of the ocean, and there are explosions and flames. And it's based on a true story. It's about these guys trying to desperately to survive, put out the fire, and be rescued. This is directed by Peter Berg, who's an actor, went on to direct a bunch of movies, including Lone Survivor with Mark Wahlberg from a couple of years ago. This also has Kate Hudson in it and Gina Rodriguez. And, I mean, for me, the reason why I want to see it, Kurt Russell's in it, and he's the man. I hear mixed things about this. Evidently, if you see it in an IMAX theater, the effects are great, the explosions are exciting, the action is well put together, but the characters are not very defined. Sort of a two-dimensional look at the characters, but, you know, big explosions and action that are really well done.
Love so. Kate Hudson too. I mean, she plays the wife, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Does she have a huge role though?
Well, she's not on the oil rig, obviously.
Yeah.
So she'll be the let's cut to the crying wife every once in a while part.
Love her. Love Kate Hudson. By the way, Nick, you'd be very proud of me. I caught up, having a 9-hour flight to Athens and an 11-hour flight back, I caught up on, I think, every movie that I missed, including some great ones like 13 Hours and some terrible ones like Boss with Melissa McCarthy.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Oh, that's
I stopped true. That probably 2 minutes in.
Yeah, it's a terrible movie.
Yeah, and then I felt for you because I thought, oh, man, what do you do when you see a movie? What do you do when you see a movie like that and you think, oh, God, this is going to be horrendous and I have to sit here for 2 more hours?
Yeah, just either grin and bear it. I very rarely, if ever, walk out of a movie. Sometimes I'll just skip it because I'm getting too old and I'm just like, I'm not going to wait. I'm going to waste my time on this. I got two guys who review movies with me every Monday morning. So sometimes I'll go, look, you go see the Tyler Perry movie. I'm done.
What was the last movie you walked out of?
Oh, man. It was year. Okay, I can tell you exactly what it was. Okay. I walked out of, God, this is almost 20 years ago. I walked out of the Jerry Springer movie Ringmaster.
Oh,
okay, I get that.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah.
It was like loosely based on Jerry Springer's talk show, but it was, and I lasted about 40 minutes and I went, I'm gone. And it's not like I haven't wanted to walk out of movies over the past bunch of years, because I've seen a lot of horrendous movies.
Mm-hmm.
But I just have not, I haven't walked out. Now, I will say this, with the advent of video on demand, it's easier to, you know, when I'm reviewing movies that are in theaters and also on demand, it's much easier for me to turn it off when I'm at home. You know,
right.
Like I said, last week, Rob Zombie had a horror film that was released called 31, and it was in theaters and it was video on demand. I watched it at home here on video on demand, and I lasted exactly, according to the timer, 38 minutes.
Oh, that seems long.
And I turned it off, and because Rob Zombie is like literally one of the worst filmmakers that's ever made movies.
Yeah, he should stick to singing.
I don't think
he's that good at that.
Living Dead Girl, come on.
One more this weekend. Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children.
Yes, Tim Burton's new movie. This looks great. A lot of people have given up on Tim Burton. They haven't liked the movie that he's made in a long time. I happen to still think the guy's great, and this seems to be like the perfect material match to the director. It's about a large group of children who live in an alternate universe, who live in this home because they have special powers, and they're considered freaks outside in the other world. And there are a group of evil doers who want to stop these children, led by Samuel L. Jackson. The great Eva Green plays Mrs. Peregrine, who is an incredible actress, who just was amazing on the Showtime show Penny Dreadful, which is one of the best shows in the history of cable. She's a terrific actress, and it looks, I mean, the trailers are all great. It looks like Tim Burton at his best. It looks incredibly imaginative. It's based on a hugely popular worldwide book, mm-hmm. You know, I'm really looking forward to it. Like I said, I'm still a big Tim Burton fan, and this looks like the perfect material for Tim Burton. And yeah, I think that's the one I'm most looking forward to.
Looks like a cool movie. We're all looking forward to your screening of The Exorcist next Tuesday.
Ooh. Yeah, Tuesday the 4th, The Exorcist director's cut, an extra 12 minutes of fun. Mm. And if you've not seen this thing on the big screen, it's pretty amazing. And the tickets are selling really good. If you want to get tickets, it's only $10. Parking is free. Best way to kick off the Halloween season is to see The Exorcist on the big screen.
I totally agree. Nick, I saw this movie in the theater many years ago, and it was obviously they brought it back and showed it on the big screen. There's nothing like seeing this movie on the big screen. It will scare the living you-know-what out of you.
Big screen. No, I don't want to see it on a little screen.
Not for me.
But he's right, though. A great way to kick off the Halloween spirit.
Oh, it would be, but not for me.
You're not doing it.
I would love to come, though, Nick, next time.
Yeah.
people are already, I mean, we've got a lot of reservations. And again, Carmike.com, Carmike, Carmike.com, reserve your seats now. People are already freaking out. I've been getting texts and Facebook posts and stuff from people saying, look, I'm coming, but I'm going to freak out.
Yeah.
And my mother, when my mother saw the movie back when it came out in 73, I remember my parents came home from seeing it, and she kept the lights on for like 3 nights.
I did the same thing. When I saw it on the big screen, I slept with the lights on that night.
Yeah, and she was freaked out. And then secretly, my dad took me to see it we didn't tell my mom. My dad took me to see it, and I was 8. I was 8 years old when I saw The Exorcist.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That would explain a few things.
Yeah, really good. Hey, real quick. Yeah. You hear who's playing Trump on SNL?
Oh, yeah, Alec Baldwin.
Alec Baldwin.
Yeah.
I can't wait. And I know it'll open this, because this is the season premiere is this Saturday.
Saturday night.
Margot Robbie is, mm-hmm. is the host. And I know they'll start with the debate. And, you know, Kate McKinnon as Clinton and Donald Trump is Alec Baldwin. It's going to kill.
There's so much there. So much material.
Well, when I watched the debate Monday night, I got on the show for Tuesday morning to talk, and we did, you know, because we watched the debate, I did a bunch of what were the best political moments in the history of SNL and political sketches. And by far the ones that we got the most mileage out of were Will Ferrell as W.
Mm-hmm.
And of course when Tina Fey came back during the 2008 election,
Sarah Palin.
It's great stuff, and I really, you know, there's so much material. Monday night provided so much material.
It's going to be
no doubt. Hey Nick, thanks. Have a great day.
All right, thanks, Nick. Care. All right, we got big story coming up next. 720 WGN.
The Steve Cochran Show.
Well, our campaign outlines big changes and bold solutions to make your life better. The Clinton campaign focuses only on small and petty distractions. Never in American history have so many serious challenges been met with so unserious a campaign as the campaign of Hillary Clinton.
This election is enormously important for the future of our country. It is imperative that we elect Hillary Clinton as our next president.
Because when making life or death, war or peace decisions, a president just can't pop off or lash out irrationally. No, we need an adult in the White House. I guarantee you.
6:42 in the morning, 720 WGN, Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, First Lady Michelle Obama going off, tearing into Donald Trump Wednesday, Dave, telling Clinton supporters that we need an adult in the White House. Boy, she was, again, going off on Trump, criticizing him spreading the birther conspiracy again, and then continuing a rebuke that she first made earlier this month while stumping for Hillary Clinton in Virginia. Boy,
Michelle Obama fired up. Everything is toned down.
I was going to say,
right?
I thought we'd...
The rhetoric is muted.
Yeah, I thought I'd come back. We'd all be happy. No, I knew.
You knew that wasn't going to happen.
You know, what's interesting, we'll talk about this with Pat Brady and Eric Adelstein later on, too, what Europeans were saying about the United States and the election again. Yeah, very, very interesting. Brad Milkey joins us now. Morning, Brad. How are you?
I'm doing well, guys. Good morning.
Hey, thanks for being with us. All right, so Trump absorbing some not-so-glowing debate reviews. Now his campaign says that he will be better next time. What are they saying about his unpreparedness and his, I guess, lack of a stellar performance in the first debate.
It's really shocking. The finger pointing has started within the Trump campaign. So Donald Trump still says he won the debate. He's been pointing to some unscientific polls to sort of back him up there. But even within his campaign, there are senior level sources telling us there were missed opportunities, is the word they were using, that he didn't really get through the checklist of things that he should have brought up. They've criticized him for not doing mock debates, and they said he should have prepared for questions like birtherism and comments about women in the past. And then, shockingly, one senior source even told us the issue wasn't prep, but his execution. He said that Trump, quote, pulled some punches, lost his nerve. So that's essentially somebody on the highest echelon to the Trump campaign telling us that the boss choked.
Yeah, and it's weird to hear the excuses, too. About the microphone. When that came out, I thought, you got to be kidding me. Now you're going to blame the microphone was sabotaged?
Well, and there were people, you know, coming out of this debate who said, you know, perhaps Trump held his own, perhaps even won parts of the first half, and that Hillary Clinton clearly did better in the second half. Well, the narrative then really shifted to Hillary Clinton clearly won this debate. If he's complaining about the moderators and the microphones, then that is the sign of somebody who knows himself that he did not have a good night. And so now you've got Hillary Clinton sort of on this victory tour. She's going to swing states, and Donald Trump, again, while he continues to say he won, mired in sort of this finger pointing within his own campaign. And so now his campaign says that there's going to be more prep going forward, that Chris Christie will actually be more involved with these debate prep sessions as they head into this town hall style format in St. Louis.
Brad, is there any evidence that he is going to take this advice from his advisors to heart and actually make the changes they're recommending?
Yeah, that's the question, right? I mean, you can talk about preparing him all you want, but if the candidate that doesn't actually want to do the work, then it's not going to get done. I think that you could imagine him maybe spending more time on it. The question will also just be about his temperament. The ghostwriter for The Art of the Deal was sort of recruited by Hillary Clinton to tell her about what Trump is like, and they said, you know, what kind of Trump should we expect? And he said, you guys, there is no different Trump. The one who gets into these mudslinging contests, the one who gets into personal insults, that is the only Donald Trump I've ever met in public or in private. You're not going to find some different version when you come out of the debate stage. So I don't know if Donald Trump will actually shift his tone. As for, you know, how prepared he'll be, I think there will be more set pieces that he knows he needs to hit. Remember, Benghazi was never brought up at Monday's debate by Lester Holt or by Donald Trump. And he had someone in the audience. His campaign had invited a Benghazi survivor so that Donald Trump could specifically say, this is so-and-so, and here's what he did, here's his story, and Donald Trump never did it.
Unbelievable. What I don't like, I know it's political season, I know we're going to see the attacks, but I really think, and I don't think this is going to happen, but I think the personal lives, as far as the children, should be off limits. And I didn't like the fact that Trump alluded to the fact that he didn't want to aggressively attack Clinton too much on the Bill Clinton scandal with Chelsea seated in the audience. And he's kind of made notations in the past day or so that he's going to start bringing up that sexual misconduct scandal with Bill Clinton. I don't think that's a good move on his part.
Well, and he brought it up by saying he didn't bring it up, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the thing.
Right.
You go to the spin room and say, I didn't even say this. And then you start extemporizing, start talking about what you didn't say, therefore, in effect, bringing it up yourself. He's also been, there's been some really shocking things from the people around him and from around Hillary Clinton. Remember Howard Dean saying that Donald Trump was on cocaine?
Yeah.
Later, you had Rudy Giuliani saying that Hillary Clinton was too stupid to be president if she didn't immediately believe that Monica Lewinsky's stories were true. And then now you have Newt Gingrich raising the rumor that perhaps Hillary Clinton got the debate questions ahead of time. I mean, these are shocking things from previous presidential candidates that are now on the sides of these two opponents.
But he continues to claim a victory, right? He's pointing to polls which show him winning 80% to 20% in the debate.
Well, here's the thing. So he's been pointing to online polls, which are basically if you are a consumer of that website, you go there and it says who you think won the debate. Well, then you're only getting people that go to that website. The more scientific polls say Hillary Clinton won. However, we don't really have great polling right now because these flash polls done overnight are not usually as strong as the ones that take place over several days. I think when we start seeing polling come out later this week or over the weekend, that's when we'll really get a handle on where these candidates are at.
Right, and no doubt he has to be better prepared, at least with the answers about the economy and ISIS, and he's just has to prep.
Yeah, there were questions there that you knew he would get, like about birtherism, that he simply didn't have an answer for. When he said, "I say nothing to those people," I mean, that was really a sign that he was sort of either flagging just in terms of stamina, and by the way, stamina is something he prides himself on,
right.
Or that he just didn't have the answers in his back pocket. Hillary Clinton, meanwhile, she ignored things herself and simply didn't acknowledge when Donald Trump would bring up things like NAFTA, and so her game plan clearly was, I'll just ignore the things I don't want to talk about and talk about the things I do want to talk about. And so we'll see if maybe Donald Trump or the moderators press her more on those issues.
Well, we'll see. It'll be interesting. Thank you, Brad. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Brad.
Thank you.
It's ABC's Brad Mielke from obviously ABC News talking about the debate and town hall meeting in St. Louis, the next one. And then the final debate is on the 29th in Las Vegas. So it'll be interesting. We'll see what happens.
40 days away. 40 more days
right?
of this.
40 more days of this. In the morning, 720 WGN. It is the Steve Cochran Show. Dave Ennett, Andrea Darlis, holding down the fort. Steve will be back on Monday. I believe Justin Kaufman will be in with us tomorrow, Dave.
Yes, he will.
It'll be nice. In the 7 o'clock hour, Pat Brady and Eric Adelstein will be here. And we're also going to talk with the director of the new Clinton documentary, Clinton Inc. Yep. Very interesting about the Clinton family.
Yeah, Doug Sain, the executive producer, will be with us.
Yeah, it'll be very cool. All right, so when I was gone, again, I knew we weren't going to all be joining hands and singing Kumbaya, but apparently Gary Johnson had another gaffe.
So last night with Chris Matthews, did you hear this?
I did hear it, and you have to listen to this.
Who's your favorite foreign leader?
Who's my favorite?
Just name anywhere in the country, any one of the continents, any country. Name one foreign leader that you respect and look up to. Anybody.
Mine was Shimon Peres.
No, okay, I'm talking about living. Go ahead. You got to do this. Anywhere, any continent. Canada, Mexico, Europe over there, Asia, South America, Africa. Name a foreign leader that you respect.
I guess I'm having an Aleppo moment in the former president of Mexico.
But I'm giving you the whole world.
I know.
Anybody
I know.
In the world you like. Anybody. Pick any leader.
The former president of Mexico.
Which one?
I'm having a brain.
Anybody.
Fox. Zedillo.
Fox. Who's your favorite foreign leader? Get him off the hook. Name a foreign leader you respect.
He was terrific.
Any foreign leader?
Merkel.
Okay, Merkel. Okay, fine. Save yourself.
Fine. Just say Queen Elizabeth.
Just say somebody. Say somebody.
Yeah.
Well, you know what, though? All right, I'll look for the silver lining in this. At least he didn't say Vladimir Putin.
Look, at that point, that might have at least shown some awareness.
Oh, my God.
All right. Kim Jong-un.
Really, now at this point, they should probably just go away. This is the alternative.
I guess I'm having an Aleppo moment.
Yeah, speaking of that, so I brought you guys back some olive oil soap, and our tour guide, which is it's made with the pure EVOO, and it makes your skin nice and soft. Mm-hmm. So I asked our tour guide, and she said, but my favorite are the products, the skincare products from Aleppo. She said, but we can't get those anymore, obviously, because of the crisis that's going on in Syria. And I said, speaking of Aleppo, so I started to tell her the story. And when I said it, she looked at me and she said, are you kidding me? This is a man who wants to run for president? I said, apparently, yeah. So nothing's changed, huh?
Remember when he was in here?
Yeah.
We were so impressed by him.
We were, but a lot of people say that those two should be switching spots, although I don't even know if I would want Gary Johnson to be the vice presidential candidate right now. But, I mean, pick a leader. Why was it hard? Who's your favorite leader?
My Queen Elizabeth.
Carmi, who's yours?
I mean...
Who's your favorite world leader?
I'm going to go with President Abdul Hamid from Bangladesh. Never met him, but he sounds like a great man.
Yeah. By the way, he's got Wikipedia up right now.
Yeah.
I can physically see it.
Carmen's Googling world leaders.
Honestly, I don't know really. I mean, he's running for president. He should know, but I wouldn't say it's got a huge relevance that off the top of his head he can't name his favorite leader. I mean,
I think it is if you're running for president. I think it's pretty relevant.
You will forgive because it's you and we love you.
It's of moderate importance. I'd rather, there's other things that I'd want him to know.
It'd be like me saying, okay, name your favorite Major League Baseball manager. Name one.
Can't think of any.
And you can't say Joe Madden.
Theo Epstein.
Oh,
Jed Hoyer.
Yeah.
Rick Hahn. No, yes, Bennett, okay, no. Fine. It's yes, he obviously he should know.
Well, at least one. Merkel. I bet you
at least Angela Merkel. I mean, come on.
Yeah, and you know what? I bet he didn't even know her first name. Did you see the poor? I sort of felt bad. He's struggling. Merkel? Like it's a question? Yes. Is that Jeopardy, dude?
I also like to say shame on Mike Jacobson for calling out my Wikipedia searcher. That's not legal.
Mike, who's your favorite world leader? Say it as Mary.
I'm a big Queen fan too. Love Queen Elizabeth.
Love Bohemian Rhapsody.
Seems very nice.
Love Queen.
Who's the leader of Barbados?
Okay.
Oh, well, this is not trivia. We're not running for president.
Yeah, we're not the ones on the
Bulgaria.
I
mean
Bogota, Colombia.
Okay, but again, Mark, he's running for president.
I get it. Right, I'm just a sympathetic guy. Okay, how about Djibouti? Can I get that out there?
We'll have more hijinks and merriment next on WGN.
This is the Steve Cochran Show.
She has saved his life politically. Now she gets her payment.
He's the charmer. She's kind of lacking in charm, but she's got ruthlessness.
Bill saw Hillary in the same way Franklin saw Eleanor.
She knows what she's getting into. She knows she's not marrying someone who is going to be completely faithful and dedicated to her 24 hours a day. But she also knows she's marrying someone who she believes is the partner with whom she can make the difference in life that she wants to make.
Well, the Clintons are about power and about money.
I mean, Whitewater is nothing compared to Hillary's conflict of interest sitting on the board of Walmart.
It wasn't that they became more liberal. It was that they became more corrupt.
The Clinton Foundation exists as a temptation for any foreign entity or government that believes it could curry favor through a donation.
They want things for sure. They'll break new grounds in weirdness at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
It's a brand new documentary. Clinton Inc. premieres in Chicago tomorrow in 20 theaters before it goes nationwide on October 14th. And with 40 days to go until the election, It's a must-see. It really is. We have the executive producer of Clinton Inc. in our studio with us, Doug Sain. Thanks for being here, Doug.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
All right. So this is a nonpartisan documentary that goes behind closed doors to reveal the makings of the Clinton dynasty. Is it impossible to do a nonpartisan documentary like this?
It is. I know that people seem rather shocked, especially in this day and age when media often is so polemic, you know, on the right or the left. And it's hard to really get that kind of insight into people that is human and kind of real. And so that was what we strive for. We have respected experts from the left, the right, and the center. And when I say the center, it's people like preeminent historian William Che from Duke University, Dr. John Gartner, who's a psychologist from Johns Hopkins University. And both of them wrote very well-researched exposés and biographies about the Clintons.
First of all, why Chicago to roll it out?
Well, it is the home of Hillary Clinton, mm-hmm. So you know, without a doubt, we wanted to be here.
What I find interesting, okay, you say that there was a main part of the documentary, a psychological profile conducted of both Bill and Hillary Clinton. To me, that right there, that could be the whole documentary.
Well, it's a very integral part, because once you understand the individual personalities and their marital relationship and how they function together, then everything becomes much more clear and understandable in terms of the policies and the way that their lives are shaped.
It'd be very interesting to see. Again, nonpartisan documentary. It's called Clinton Inc. Is there, I guess we'll learn this when we see the documentary, and I don't want to give too much away because it looks fascinating to me. And I think it would be fascinating to a lot of people, whether you're a Hillary supporter or a Trump supporter. Their relationship, though, I think it wouldn't be a shock to say, seems very similar to the House of Cards relationship, the Kevin Spacey, Robin Wright relationship,
sure. Well,
the partnership more than the love affair.
Well, House of Cards in some ways was kind of made to be similar and have that feel. This certainly Clinton Inc., though, is authentic. It is very real. It isn't fictionalized in any way.
But, so Bill never tossed anybody on the L tracks?
Pat Brady in studio with us now as well. Pat, say hey to Doug.
Yeah, talks directly to the audience. Yeah.
But that's what it's built like. Again, it just seems more of a partnership at this point. And the clip was great. He's had his just do. He's done his. Now it's her turn.
Right. And we used kind of the business model to understand the Clintons and their relationship, because so many times you're trying to understand, what is the marriage? Is it one just for, you know, each other to achieve their ambitions? Is there a codependency going on there? And I think for audiences, understanding the relationship is something that is relatable. People can see and feel. It's like knowing your neighbors and your family. You know them through that relationship first. And so it really makes once you unlock that key to the door, everything opens up.
Hey, the question that's coming up now, and I'm wondering if you could kind of cut to this, that's most relevant in this campaign, I think anyway, that might come up in the town hall in the next 40 days. What is exactly the role of the Clinton Foundation and Clinton Inc.?
Mm. Well, the Clinton Foundation, much like the Clintons themselves, started off with this ideological opportunity for the president to do, much like former President Jimmy Carter, to do good things in the world. It certainly, over time, evolved into something else. And you're right, the Clinton Foundation has been their stepping stone in a way that I think most people, you know, already have very strong questions, already have
what raises the questions? I'm not sure if everybody understands what the questions are, because the do-gooder thing, we all agree with. What's the question? Are there conflicts with their respective roles that we're talking about now that are relevant to the election?
Yeah, the conflicts are, you know, certainly when this foundation is kind of outside the norms of a typical nonprofit charity, because it's the former president's foundation. And yet at the same time, you have his wife, Hillary Clinton, who served as a U.S. senator and then as Secretary of State. And it changed, too. It went from being the William Jefferson Clinton Foundation to the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation. And one of the key parts in the movie is about how Chelsea almost brings the Clinton Foundation down.
Wow.
Was there any cooperation from the Clintons or anyone close to the Clintons?
You know, it's funny.
Or did you seek it?
Martin Scorsese was authorized to do a documentary for the Clintons, and in the end, he couldn't get a documentary movie out because they wanted final creative control. And so I thought to myself,
from Scorsese,
and so I thought, you know, there's no way if Scorsese can't do it, I can't get, you know, an authorized version. But the Clinton campaign did contact me about a year ago when it was announced in the New York Times that this movie was going to be made. And I offered to them to do an interview and got no response back.
Maybe it'll generate some Oscar buzz, too. Can you hang with us for a little bit, Doug?
Absolutely. Okay. This is my fight song. Take back my life
song. Prove I'm all right song. 7:22 in the morning. 7:20 WGN. It is the Steve Cochran Show. Dave and I holding down the fort until tomorrow. Justin Kaufman will be in tomorrow. Steve back on Monday. And we're excited to have Doug Sane in studio with us this morning, the executive producer of Clinton Inc., a new documentary that's going to go nationwide October 14th, but premiering in Chicago tomorrow. And where can we see that?
Well, if you go to the Clinton Inc., the movie.com website, you'll be able to see the full listing of 21 theaters throughout the region. But as an example, at the River East AMC, we're having a kind of a premiere party at 8:15 tomorrow.
Okay, and it's a nonpartisan documentary. It goes behind closed doors to reveal the makings of the Clinton dynasty. And what I found interesting just before the break, Doug, you said Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton, are they guided by love, ambition, charity, and or greed, or all of the above? And you said Chelsea, and I said, I really wasn't aware that she had that much of a role in the foundation until you said she basically almost brought it down. But I never thought she would be the next political, you know.
Yeah, it's very much a dynasty in the sense they are, you know, Bill and Hillary would love to see this perpetuated on. They have great visions for themselves. One moment in the movie, we talk about how they see each other as kind of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. And I'm sure you've heard those aspirations before.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, without a doubt, they have very high ambitions.
Doug, how do you think the movie will be received by those who support Hillary Clinton and those who support Donald Trump?
Well, I think that, you know, it's been really great to do this movie and get the feedback from both sides of the aisle. And it's really been positive. It may come as a surprise for many people, but even people who are supporters of Hillary Clinton really appreciate the movie. I think for people on the right, they sometimes walk away saying, you know, I have a better appreciation for who Hillary is, in the sense that she fought so much to keep her marriage together. And I think that resonates, too, with those on the left, political spectrum. And these are real people. We get into kind of their complexities and nuances and foibles. So there's a lot going on there. And again, it's something that you can relate to. It's something like you would see in your family or in your friends. And I think that's a real advantage of those movies, to be able to get into that kind of depth and understanding. Because so often in the news, we're kind of real split second, and we just kind of get those polemic takes.
Did Clinton Inc., was it formed when they started dating, or did it evolve? I mean, did they have this planned out at all, where they'd end up?
You know, when they first met, it was a romantic relationship and quickly turned into this
business
partnership.
This partnership of ambition.
Boy, very House of Cards-y.
Is the story true about how they met in the library and him talking about watermelons and stuff like that? Or,
well, no one's ever disputed it. And I'm not sure whether it just fits their, you know, ambitions in and of themselves to have a delightful tale from the beginning. But for the most part, there's no reason not to believe it.
Did she stay with him for the political future, for the political foundation?
You know, it's really funny. They flipped roles. And when I say that, I mean, typically the man would come to the beautiful woman and might say, oh, you should be with me. I'm the one who can provide for you. You know, whether you love me or not, I'm the guy you should be with. Well, Hillary did that to Bill. You may not think that I'm the cat's beehive, but I'm the one you should stay with because I'm the one who can help you achieve your goals.
You know, when he won the primary here, St. Patrick's Day, 1992, which basically won him the Democratic nomination. And I remember at the Hilton, she was on stage, and of the two, was the most impressive.
Yeah, they've always been a two-for-one package.
Yeah, well, they had to give up the two-for-one because it politically didn't work after she talked about baking cookies and some other things that wasn't so great. But I remember, you know, almost 30 years ago, watching her, and she really was much more out front in the performance than she was when he was president.
Sure. Well, she was very instrumental in his early campaigns as attorney general and as governor in the state of Arkansas.
She caught so much grief, right, for not changing her name initially, and then when he lost, they had to retool four or five times, haven't they, with her relationship with him, just to meet the mood?
Oh, yes. They've had their ups and downs, without a doubt.
But even politically, when she was Hillary Rodham, she would, in Arkansas in the 70s, that probably wasn't too well received.
Well, you know, there's a funny line from the right that she's kind of a shapeshifter, and she definitely modifies herself.
I mean, that's when, I'm not dinging her for that, but she was, there's been a lot of changes. Yeah,
the accent, the hair, the styles.
Right.
And her demeanor, too. I mean, at some points, she would often she would be the one who would go and debate his opponents.
Yeah, I remember reading that. She was much more out front in Arkansas. Does she understand? Eric just walked in, who actually ran the Clinton campaign here in Illinois. Does she accept that role, that she's not quite as good retail as him?
I think it's well understood, yeah. And she recognized that from the very beginning.
Will he embellish his role as first gentleman if she wins? I mean, there's no way he's going to just become Mr. Let's go for a photo op. I mean, I'm sure he's going to have a role in a Hillary Clinton White House
Yeah, we get into that in the movie, and there's a lot of different perspectives on what will happen, but certainly there's no way to see him being just a bystander or, you know, the guy who picks the dinner table seats.
Will he have an office in the White House like she did?
Oh, you would have to believe so.
Oh, I'm sure he will.
Yeah.
Yeah, he'd have to. He'll create one.
Will Melania Trump have one?
I would.
That's in Trump Inc.
I would expect him to be quite the international leader.
I would expect to see that as well. Well, either way, go see it. It's a fantastic documentary. Clinton Inc. Again, it premieres right here in Chicago September 30th, tomorrow, in 20 theaters throughout the metro area, and it goes nationwide on October 14th. Best of luck. Thank you, Doug Sain.
Thank you, Doug. Thank you. Thank
Appreciate
you, everyone.
It. We'll be back after this. 720 WGN.
Back to the Steve Cochran Show.
I've been out from June 16th. It's been full time. All the time. You see all the days off that Hillary takes? Day off. Day off. Day off. All those day offs. And then she can't even make it to her car. Isn't it tough?
7:39, the Steve Cochran Show. Andre Darlis, Dave Ennett in for Steve this morning. We continue the political discussion. We get away from the cinematic political discussion. Pat Brady, Eric Edelstein are here, as they are every Thursday morning. And you just heard Donald Trump with the attack on Hillary Clinton. Are we going to hear now, in the wake of the debate, a change in the tone of the rhetoric in this campaign? Is it going to become even more inflammatory, Pat, than what we've heard so far?
I know Trump right now is pretty hard to see how he can change much. He's pretty much been at that extreme the whole time, so probably not from him. I don't know what Eric thinks about Secretary Clinton.
Well, I can't slightly disagree because he kind of pulled. He said he told us he pulled his punches in the debate. He didn't bring up Bill and the scandals and stuff, and basically threatened to do that. Look, I've maintained all along that Dave, to your point, can you imagine it going lower? But I think as we get closer to Election Day and Trump becomes more desperate, I don't know that there are any bounds of what is off limits for this guy. And I think, as much as that last half hour of the debate to me was kind of a jaw-dropping unraveling of a brain as you sit there and watched it, I think there's going to be a bit of the train wreck aspect to the last few weeks of this campaign. I'm not in any way taking a victory lap or suggesting it's over, but that you know, people have said when you run for president, you can't hide your character. And when the lights are this bright and the intensity of the next few weeks, I think he wilted on the biggest stage he's ever been on. And I think you're going to continue to see that unravel. And I don't know what that means, but I think it's not going to be pretty.
I heard reaction about the debate, but then actually when I got home, watched the debate, the full debate, night before last, and holy cow, I was really surprised at the lack of preparedness by Trump. I didn't think it would be that bad.
I think, too, the Clinton campaign's outsmarting Trump on every front right now. You saw what they rolled out yesterday. Bernie Sanders and Michelle Obama trying to wrap up that millennial vote. And, you know, you can like or dislike Michelle Obama or Bernie Sanders, but I watched their introductions of Hillary Clinton. They couldn't get any better for the crowd they're trying to attack. I just think Trump right now is really getting outsmarted.
Well, you know, there's the classic line of if in politics, when you're defending, you're losing. For him to come out of this debate, Pat and I were talking about it, and spend 2 days complaining about the microphone and talking about this Miss Venezuela stuff and doubling down that she really was a problem because she gained weight. I mean, this is not the narrative of a sophisticated presidential operation. I mean, people make flubs. Debates are all about that. But then you do damage control and you try to move past it in the news cycle. This guy sort of wades right into it. And it just reinforces everybody's negative views of him.
And to bring up the Clinton, or alluding to the fact that, well, I could have brought this up, but I didn't because the Clinton misconduct, Bill Clinton misconduct, sexual misconduct scandal, because Chelsea was sitting in the audience. Bad move. If I'm Kellyanne Conway, I'm saying, don't bring that up. Well, that's just the wrong way to go.
Yeah, and the first, I think, real or legitimate poll is out this morning on who won. It was clearly they thought the poll said that most folks thought that Secretary Clinton won, but to me, there 26% of the people polled thought that Donald Trump hurt himself and he didn't have the quote-unquote temperament to be president, which was his mission in this debate, was to establish that he could actually be commander-in-chief. And that, to me, was the only thing he needed to do, and he failed miserably.
I mean, I just, in a microcosm, a man that cannot stand there for 90 minutes and have a adult conversation about serious issues affecting this country and this world, who takes the bait and ends up acting like he's a grade schooler, and the attention deficit stuff. There was one answer, you know, where he sort of talked about seven things that had nothing to do with national security, which was the question. And then really the topper, that question about the Russians hacking
the hackers,
system and saying, well, it could have been the Russians or it could have been some 400-pound fat guy. Yeah. I mean, it's like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, why did he have to say 400-pound fat guy? And why, again...
It's redundant, isn't it?
Yeah. But even the defending the Russians, one, it is out there that he won't release his tax returns because he has business interests in Russia, and he speaks very favorably of former KGB member Vladimir Putin, who wants nothing more than to see this country blow up, that he just walks into the things that people like me don't like about him.
Right. And then, you know, the line about, and I don't know, maybe this helps, so maybe I live in a bubble, but when she says, you know, maybe he doesn't release tax returns because he didn't pay any taxes, what does that say about somebody? And he goes, it makes them smart. You know,
so much for
smart
man of the people.
Not to play
but
taxes?
You know what, though? I mean, but
well,
see,
yeah, but
he's playing the populist thing. And
right.
We all pay
Everyone would like to not pay
but
taxes,
CNN
but we
did,
don't get
CNN
to do that.
CNN did a follow-up on that, and I know it's CNN. I know what people say about, you know, mainstream media and CNN can be liberal, but they were asking Trump supporters, what do you think about that? And they said, oh, that's okay. That's all right. Well, it's good that he found a way out of this system.
But we know what the Trump supporters are. Trump's, like he said, what he can do and still have his support. And this town hall, he has to reach out to more than just Trump supporters, and he needs to win some suburban women, particularly in a state like Pennsylvania not only will he lose Pennsylvania, but he's going to take our candidate down there with him if he doesn't improve in the suburbs there.
Isn't that what this is really about now? It's the Trump supporters, those who have decided on Donald Trump to this point, are going to stay in the Trump camp. And those who have decided on Hillary Clinton are going to stay with her. And it's the undecideds. And also maybe that, what is it, 11% with the libertarians right now that they have to go after, that Hillary Clinton in particular has to go after?
Yeah, I think Gary Johnson's conduct last night might make it easier for those who are undecided who to vote for.
He
couldn't identify.
His
Chris Matthews
moment.
Goes, who's your favorite world leader? And he couldn't identify one.
He said, just name one. Name one world leader. One world leader. Here, listen, Mike has it.
Who's your favorite foreign leader?
Who's my favorite?
Just name anywhere in the country. Any one of the continents, any country. Name one foreign leader that you respect and look up to. Anybody.
Mine was Shimon Peres.
No, okay, I'm talking about living. Go ahead. You got to do this. Anywhere, any continent. Canada, Mexico, Europe over there, Asia, South America, Africa. Name a foreign leader that you respect.
I guess I'm having an Aleppo moment in the former president of Mexico.
But I'm giving you the whole world.
I know.
Anybody in the world you like. Anybody. Pick any leader.
The former president of Mexico.
Which one?
I'm having a brain.
Name anybody.
Fox. Zedillo.
Fox.
Okay, who's your favorite foreign leader? Get him off the hook. Name a foreign leader you respect.
He was terrific.
Any foreign leader?
Merkel.
Okay, Merkel. Okay, fine. Save yourself.
Oh, the audience is going, oh.
Okay.
There are 194 countries,
can,
right?
Can I just say, and I'm not a doctor, but anyone who questions the impact of recreational marijuana on memory, all they have to do is listen to that clip for somebody who avows recreational use as Gary Johnson does. I mean, that's remarkable.
It's completely remarkable. And you know, I wanted to bring this up too to you guys.
He had
some
a bag
of the response
of potato
from...
chips behind him. Did you see that?
I do watch Doritos. Rag Doritos. Dog on the plane. Yeah, exactly. I want to bring up too some overseas response as well, because I get a lot of foreigners, Athens, and then from Germany as well, responding to the circus, as they put it, that we're going through here. . 7:52 in the morning, 7:20 WGN. It's the Steve Cochran Show. Dave and Andrea Darlis in for Steve. Steve will be back on Monday. Justin Coffin will be our guest host tomorrow morning. Mark Cameron on sports. Mary Vandeveld in traffic. Mike and Mary producing the program. And Vic Vaughn and Steve Grzanich handling the news duties
and
today.
Ryan Burrow. That's everybody.
I think we just covered everybody.
Can you say Mark Harmon doing an amazing job on sports?
Mark Harmon doing an amazing job on sports today.
And you forgot about Bennett.
Bennett Wake Night, one of our associate producers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Todd Manley, our boss.
Sophia
Castor,
will be in
boss.
Here in a minute.
Sophia's our friend.
She is. Oh, absolutely. She's our
We're
friend.
We're talking politics, Pat Brady, Eric Edelstein. All right. So when I was in Athens and overseas, one of the nights we were in the bar area near the pool and met a couple of.
Really?
Yeah, I know. It was vacation.
You
seem
like you were always near the pool. Did you ever sightsee?
You know, Mary, let me tell you, we usually finished off the night with a nightcap by the pool.
A little ouzo by the pool.
A little ouzo by the pool.
I was texting by the pool.
Exactly. Keeping up on world events by the pool. But there was a group of German tourists who sat with us one night, and they literally said she was a professor at the university just outside of Munich, several degrees. She teaches political science. She said, what is going on with the circus over there? She said, who's going to win? I said, well, if I knew the answer to that, that's the $64 million question. But the perception that not only just the Europeans, but overseas with this political circus, that it is. I mean, it is what it is. I hate to call it a circus, but do you see that as well? I mean, do you see a lot of people from overseas just looking at the United States right now? And do you think that will hurt us in the long run?
I think it's already hurt us. I mean, I think people in the United States are looking at this as a circus, and I think people abroad even more so. I think we still, despite the cynicism and everything, we still are, you know, in many ways the last great hope and the oldest democracy in the world. And when it becomes kind of this game and trivialized and turned into reality television, I think that diminishes not just the United States, but sort of the whole kind of experiment. And I don't mean to get on my soapbox or give a civics lesson, but I just think regardless of who you're for, Republican or Democrat, ultimately it's bad for the system. And I know it's an ugly process, and the old line about, you know, democracy is the worst form of government except for all the other forms, because it is messy at times. Mm-hmm. But I don't think this helps anything. I really don't.
I agree. I would like to see, not only from the president and others, the things that we used to hear from President Reagan about the exceptionalism of this country, and we are the last great hope for the world, the shining city on the hill, the last beacon of democracy, whatever you want to say. I'd like to see a return to more of that in the next campaign, because this is not just bad for the United States, it's bad for the world. And these people, they want to make fun of us, but they look to us. Mm-hmm. When somebody's in trouble, where do you come? You come to the United States.
Oh, absolutely.
So we need to be strong for the world to be strong and safe, and right now we're not. And you can blame probably both the candidates in the campaign, but I think the rhetoric coming from the nominee of my party has been very damaging, not only to the process, but to the country.
You know, and I think there was a remarkable moment in that debate, a lot of remarkable moments, but a genuine moment where you had Hillary Clinton, who's been on the international stage and understands world leaders. And I'm not, this is not a making a case for her, but you could see her genuine concern when they had that discussion about not meeting our obligations to our allies, and sort of the loose rhetoric that I don't think Trump means it, because he doesn't know what the hell he's talking about, but talking about Japan, talking about Saudi Arabia, talking about South Korea, and letting
the whole
them
NATO
loose.
I mean, has the whole, he not read a NATO history book stuff on why?
You could just see the concern on her face, like put like, oh my God, this guy has no. You're talking about a post-war era, mm-hmm, that has basically prevented first world countries from going to war with each other. You know, despite how violent the world still is since World War II, we've avoided a major, you know, clash of two first, you know, first world powers. And well, he's basically threatening that.
We won the Cold War. The problem is in 91, 92, we didn't, when the world had changed, we didn't, we're still trying to figure out what our role is, mm-hmm, I think. And I think that's the debate amongst both sides. Are we the going to be the world's policeman, or are we going to stay out of everything like Trump wants to be isolationist? I don't think isolationism historically has ever worked.
Right.
But that's what Trump wants to do.
And I agree. But I think it goes slightly even further, which is we can have that honest debate and, you know, respect people who take that view, whether you like it or not. But the notion that we're not going to meet, you know, live up to obligations and treaties and commitments that we've made for half a century, that's very alarming to people.
I still, to this day, from the criticism he had of a member of the judiciary to the statements he makes like that, does not understand the fundamental role of the President of the United States, the separation of powers, and the significance that every word that comes out of his mouth means to the rest of the world. I don't think he understands that. That's why I think he's such a dangerous candidate. Yeah.
Guys, what role will the millennials play? Because we had seen they were engaged in the Sanders campaign. Bernie Sanders comes out, makes an appearance yesterday for Hillary Clinton, and it seemed like you were kind of getting that 60s vibe a little bit as far as the campuses. I mean, kids were getting involved in the process. If there were ever a time that they should be, it would seem to be this year. Do you see this becoming more of an issue as we get 40 days down the road?
Well, I think there's no question the protest votes that you're seeing for Johnson and to some extent for Stein, a lot of that does come out of what would be a normal base for Hillary Clinton. So I think there is concern. I think Pat mentioned it, why you had Michelle Obama and Sanders out there talking about that. I think they do become a key constituency. You know, how big they turn out and where they go, I don't think they're going to make or break this election, but I think it's an interesting development. And the message that Michelle, First Lady, is trying to get out there is, you know, if you don't vote, or if you vote for a protest candidate, you are effectively voting for Donald Trump. So take responsibility for your vote and cast it accordingly.
Mm-hmm. Tough to get them out. And my critique of the Clinton campaign, and we'll just put Trump aside for a second, is she's so the least aspirational candidate I've ever seen. She doesn't fire you up to get out there, even like Bernie did. And it's not an age or a sex thing. It's just her message is so, it's so bland and kind of out of touch right now that I don't know how you're going to get a, are you a millennial, Eric? What is a millennial?
No, I'm not.
18 to 32, isn't that the
age? I'm just slightly
just missed it.
Yeah, we all are.
But
yeah,
that needs to be like when I voted in 1980 when I was 18, because you had somebody that inspired you to get out and vote. And I don't see her message that way. Although yesterday, Michelle Obama and Bernie Sanders, I don't agree with one inch of the policy part of it, but it was pretty, if you're of that age, it might fire you up to get out.
Yeah, absolutely. Pat Brady, Eric Edelstein, thank you as always. We'll see you guys next week. And more after this on 720 WGN.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Dean Richards joins us from Channel 9.
Citizens of the world.
Some of the world's greatest entertainers are here tonight.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I present to you.
And tonight, guess what? It's going to be Dean.
Yeah, Hollywood. You know I love you more than one night.
Haven't you missed hearing that?
Yeah, I did. I'm singing along with it. But I actually was texting with Dean when I was in Athens. Dean, back me up on this. This was so funny. We were in Kalini by the beach, and somebody had internet access saying Brad and Angelina were getting a divorce. They said, it can't be true. It can't be true. Text Dean Richards. So I said, okay. So thank you, Dean, by the way. I said, so I emailed Dean and texted him, rather, and right away he said, "What did tell everybody what your response to me, Dean, was when I was asking you about Brad and Angelina.
I think very similar to how Dave responded to you this morning when you said that you were listening to WGN while you were in Santorini. You're in one of the most beautiful places on earth.
Right?
But you're listening to WGN. I mean, you know, we love our WGN and everything, but you're in Santorini, for God's sake.
I know. And everybody's saying, oh, is it true with Brad and Angelina? We're looking at ancient ruins.
Same thing is how I responded, that it's like, I can't believe that you're interested in entertainment gossip. You're, you know, in one of the most beautiful places on earth. You know, but that's the power of a Brad and Angelina, I guess.
It was strictly for the listeners, Dean.
I gave them, yeah, sure it was.
Yeah.
I gave them the scoop. This was right when the story was first breaking. Mm-hmm. So you may have been the first people in Greece to even have heard the news about the whole thing. And the next time that you go overseas, we're going to make sure you don't have any technology with you.
She wasn't just...
You Americans and your technology. And you crazy iPhones.
You're crazy.
Put your iPhones away. Look at the beautiful Greece.
Yeah, she wasn't just listening. She was watching us on the internet.
Just one day, Dean.
Yeah, that's even sadder, honestly.
I know. It's pretty pathetic, isn't it?
I got to say, I do the same thing when I'm on vacation. You get a little... That's the beautiful thing. You get a little touch of home while you're away someplace.
Little touch of home. I was very surprised, though. What's the latest update? The last I heard that you had told me, and you did break this because we had just heard about it, Dean, and you said there were all these rumors that he had cheated with Marion Cotillard. Where do we stand now on the craziness?
Marion Cotillard categorically denied the whole thing the next day. She said that, you know, she's with some... She has had a longtime boyfriend. She said that, you know, she has nothing to do with Brad Pitt, other than that they made a movie together. So that part of the story is over with. And the allegations came out that there may have been some abuse. Sources say, unnamed sources, saying that there was abuse. Brad Pitt denying that there was any sort of abuse. He has, the very latest on this from yesterday, he has submitted to drug testing because there are allegations also of alcohol and drug use. He is fully cooperating with officials to clear his name on all of this. And, you know, the divorce is definitely going to go through. That's what they're working on. So, you know, Brad and Angelina have had really nothing to say except, you know, we're putting the welfare of our children ahead of everything else. They're not saying anything. People are speculating, oh, he must be guilty. He's not saying anything. She must be guilty. She's not saying anything. They're not saying anything because they're about to be in a legal situation. So I'm sure they're just keeping their mouths shut until, you know, they settle this whole thing legally. So, you know, that's what's going on. I feel bad for the kids. You know, there's a lot of children involved in this. His parents are about to be divorced, and they are really going to be the unfortunate victims of this whole thing.
Yeah, very true, very true. You know, you've interviewed them both multiple times, Dean, and you've always described all these rumors, of course, all these internet rumors coming out about how she's all kinds of crazy, but every time you've interviewed her, you've described her as just a very stunning person.
I mean, stunningly beautiful, of course, but couldn't be nicer. Very unassuming, very friendly. You know, she's a very polarizing person. You know, some people just don't care for her. They still hold the whole Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston thing against her. All I know is when I've interviewed her, it's been a very pleasant experience. I've interviewed Brad Pitt several times. I wouldn't say unfriendly, but honestly, less friendly than Angelina Jolie. And I would also say, maybe if I was going to judge both of them on hygiene, I would ask Brad Pitt to stay in the shower a little bit longer.
Really? Wow. Dean, I love these stories. This is, yeah. These are fantastic.
You don't get that up and down the dial.
No. A little on the greasy side.
What about a Brad and Jennifer re-association, Dean? A lot of people want that.
She's happily married right now.
Yeah, come on, Mark.
Justin. Come on, Mark.
These things change.
She's happily married to Justin, what's his name?
Thoreau?
Thoreau.
Is that his name?
No. Trudeau's the Canadian.
Trudeau?
Guy, right?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, Thoreau. Right. He's got a lot of tats.
I would like her to get together with the Canadian Prime Minister, even though they probably don't even know each other.
Listen, if the Libertarian Party candidate had come up with that name
right.
last night, he'd be a lot happier this morning.
I think people would just like him to come up with any name.
Yeah, exactly.
He can't even come up. So you know where I am.
You're at the firehouse, yeah, yeah. Aren't you?
Yeah.
I'm at the firehouse, Engine Company 78, right in back of Wrigley Field, because we're having a fireman cook-off that's going on out here this morning. So we're having a burger competition, kind of like an Iron Chef style burger competition between, you know, what are arguably the greatest chefs in the world, firefighters. Our friends at Weber Grill have got a big setup out here, and all firemen and fire women are out here, and we're going to have this big competition on the Around Town feature on the TV morning news here today.
So have you already begun to grill? Have you started
we're
cooking?
We're going to begin shortly.
Okay. And you have your grill?
Got to begin shortly.
You have your Grill Daddy Pro?
You know what? I actually forgot to.
Oh, you want me to bring you mine?
The one thing that I really wanted the most this morning is I forgot to bring my Grill Daddy Pro, but we've got they have these little mini Weber grills with Cubs logos on them, painted on them. They're really cool.
I gotta get one of those.
Those
are cool.
Look great.
Really, they can be tabletop, or they have little carts that you know, so you can take them camping, or you know, if you're just having quick tailgating or whatever. They're really pretty cool. So that's what the firefighters are going to be cooking, and they're all brand spanking new this morning. So they really don't need to be grill daddied off. The official grill cleaner of WGN Radio and the Tribune Media Company.
Dean,
nice.
Dean, we know they're all great chefs.
I have to go on TV in like a minute.
Okay.
So Dean, tell us the theory of burger making. No, I'm kidding.
When you speak again,
we'll let you fly.
All right, Dean.
Back in the studio. And I'll also have the philosophy of Socrates, Plato,
excellent.
Socrates.
We love you, Dean.
Nice to have you back. We'll see you guys.
Thank you, Dean. Love you so much. He's the best. If anyone's going to judge a burger competition, it's going to be Dean Richard.
And that, by the way, a firehouse that holds a very significant place in Cubs history. Anybody know? Do you remember, Mark?
Are we talking about Tom Treblehorn?
Tom Treblehorn, 1994. Oh. Steps of the firehouse.
Were they 0-8 at that point on the way to 0-14?
They were 0-14. No, that was not the 0-14 start. That was the 0-14.
Oh, that was Riggs.
Oh, they were 0-11 at home, I believe.
Yeah.
And he said if they lost their next game, he would go on the steps of the firehouse and take questions from fans. And so after the game, I think it was a Friday afternoon, as I remember, 1994, Tom Treblehorn on the steps of that firehouse answering questions from angry Cubs fans.
Can we do great Cub managers for the next 10 minutes?
Yeah. 8:26 in the morning, 720 WGN. It's the Steve Cochran Show. Dave and Andrea in for Steve.
Dave's dancing.
On Monday, he is dancing. Dave's got the moves like Jagga. Sandberg, I missed you too.
Oh, missed you. You guys don't usually bop around when Cochran's in the studio.
It's
I know,
a
we
different
are,
vibe.
Yeah, we're bopping. So individually.
Yes, not together.
Right. No, it was a couple.
So you were in Greece.
I was.
And before you left, we had the question that every girls talk about before they go on a trip is, what are you packing?
Oh.
And so you were overpacking.
I completely overpacked.
I want to know a percentage of what clothes you actually wore.
I probably wore 60% of what I brought. Because I brought shorts for during the day because it was 80, 85 degrees. I brought a couple of pairs of like white jeans, you know, kind of nicer pants. I didn't wear one pair of pants because at night it was either dresses or skirts.
Sure.
To go out for dinner, not clubbing or
anything.
Well, plus
like you probably just bought bathing suits because it sounds like you were just at the pool the whole
time. I was at the pool. I did. I need a new bathing suit though because we went swimming in the water and it's salt water. And one of the days we were, when we were in Santorini, it was like a hot spring. And then our tour guide said, yeah, throw away the bathing suit. You know, it'll either smell like sulfur or salt.
Oh, so. Yeah. You
but it did cure
that.
Your infected knee, right?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I thought of your sister, too, because how is your sister, by the way?
Oh, she's doing okay. She had a bike accident like Andrea, so yeah. Katie. So she has a, what do you call it? Her clavicle has popped out
okay.
still.
She has a sling?
Yeah, she's still in one of those immobilizer slings.
Tell her to take a saltwater bath. I'm okay. not even kidding you. I know that sounds really weird, but...
She's a physical therapist.
Oh, my
she
God.
She doesn't take a ton of advice from other people, radio hosts, but...
Holy cow. The pain just went down by 50%. The wounds have pretty much healed.
Well, that's
nice.
Good.
Tell her to just fly to Santorini, go in the hot springs, and soak in the salt water
sounds like a good plan,
for a day.
For sure. So 60%. So next time you're going to learn from this and pack less.
Completely overpacked. Judy Pilot.
Wait, are you going to learn from it? I'm asking.
I hope so. I have to. But there was a man on our trip. He was hilarious. Donnell. He brought 15 pairs of shoes, one for every outfit.
Wow. How did he fit them all in his suitcase?
He had to have two people help him lift his trunk up, and he was way over. I think he paid double the fee. Because he was twice over the weight limit.
I didn't know guys thing. Even had 15 pairs of shoes.
Yeah, he had 15 pairs
well,
of shoes.
Well, we all know he
Well,
does.
Yeah, you do.
Why would... No, I... Well, yeah, maybe.
Running shoes.
Well, I get a lot of different running shoes. But why would you need 15 pairs of shoes for a two-week trip?
I brought four. I brought black sandals, white sandals, flip-flops for the pool, kind of some hiking sandals, and then some trendy, like,
That's five.
That's
Those Adidas.
Five.
Oh, yeah. Five. I brought five.
And
pairs
that's 10
in.
Shoes.
And you probably bought 10 more.
I just brought I bought a pair of black boots.
There
it's
you
funny
go.
You say that.
Did you notice did. The shoes or did he just say, hey, look at my new
he
shoes?
Because we said, what's in your suitcase? And he said, 15 pairs. 15.
Okay. Isn't that kind of a personal question? I mean, you just met him and you're asking him what's in his suitcase.
Don't overpack. Anybody traveling, just you decrease whatever you have by
40%. But you don't
40%.
Get charged when you're going overseas. You don't get charged as much, do you?
No,
only
it's coming
if you're
back.
Overweight.
It's coming back that you get that they weigh everything. At least they did for me.
That's because you're bringing back all the ouzo.
I was over, but they didn't charge me. Did I say that out loud? We'll be back. Big story next, WGN.
Ryan Dempster.
There's a 1-1 to Freeman. Oh, he caught it. Right into the palm of Dempster's glove.
Ooh,
that is a little smile there from Dempster.
What would Harry say right now about this win?
Well, I gotta tell you, there's a lot of champagne in here. I haven't seen this much champagne since my wedding. We had a party just like this. It was phenomenal. Go, Cubs!
That was outstanding.
The Wintrust Community Banks Hour continues, 8:40 every Thursday morning. We talk with Ryan Dempster, Dave Ennett, Andrea Darlis. Steve is off this morning. While you were gone, Andrea, while you were over in Greece, Ryan came in and spent an hour with us here. Oh, were you here?
I was here that day,
oh,
remember?
Oh, I'm sorry. You
he gave me a big hug and a kiss and sent me off
right.
to Europe.
Then sent you off to,
the right
to
way.
Greece. That's right. So, but of course, the big story this morning is, if I read the headlines correctly, Ryan has gotten a 5-year extension from the Cubs worth about $50 million. Did I get that right, Ryan?
I wish. Yeah, no, hopefully it means a little job security for me, too. No, I'm just kidding. It was obviously very well deserved for Theo. And like he said, you know, it's a collection of a staff of people that put in a lot of hard work. And, you know, he deserves every bit of this because he's put together a plan and it's on its way to come into fruition, but it's been a great thing so far, and he's built a monster of a team that's got some sustainability, and I'm glad he got rewarded for it.
Well, that's the key word, sustainability. Give us, Ryan, an inside look, because you've seen it from day one internally, and you were gone for a while and came back, but what's sort of culture change has occurred under Theo that maybe we don't see on a day in day out basis?
You know, I think it started just from kind of like a grassroots kind of build up from the bottom and make it all the way to the top. I think if you look at it, you know, the pamphlet, the Cubs way that we're going to play baseball, how we're going to represent the organization and how we're going to go about things on the field, how we're going to do things from a developmental standpoint, and an expectation of what you're going to, what's going to be expected of you as a player when you get to the big league level. So that when you do these guys come up, it becomes a seamless transition. I think that's probably the biggest difference I notice is a lot of times, especially, you know, years and years ago, not just with the Cubs, but with a lot of organizations, when guys would come up from the minor leagues, you didn't quite know what to expect, and there would be those nerves. And I think guys are taught at a very early state in their Cubs career in the minor league that this is how it's going to be. This is how we're going to play. This is how we're going to carry ourselves as human beings. This is how we're going to treat each other as teammates. And so when you get up to the big league level, that's why guys like Carl Edwards Jr. or, you know, an Addison Russell or these young guys, they just slide right in and you know, transition so well in the big leagues because there's already that program set up of how we're going to run things, how we're going to do things, and the expectations that there are for you as players.
You know, that's a great point because you look at the guys who've come up and they have seamlessly worked their way into the lineup, into the major league environment at a very young age. And I don't think you see that with other teams. You don't see that routinely in baseball where a 21-year-old or a 22-year-old comes up and just steps right in.
No, you don't. And I think there are organizations that do a good job of it. You know, I know a place that he was before because he did that in Boston. They do a good job of that. The St. Louis Cardinals do a good job of that, and I think now you know, us as the Cubs are a front runner in something like that. Just the ability to slot a young guy in, whether it's in the bullpen or in the rotation or in the starting lineup, and they don't have those nerves because they've been taught this is how it's going to be, this is how the game's going to be played, this is how fast it's going to move, and they're ready when they get there. And I think that speaks volumes, not just about Theo and Jed and Jason and all these guys in the front office, you know, Joe and that, but the way it's taught in the minor leagues, the instructors, the coaches, the coordinators, the people who are kind of grooming and molding these young players so that when they come up, they are ready to step in and make an impact right away and not just be a little piece of the puzzle. They end up being huge pieces of the puzzle.
Demp, the last time the Cubs won the division was 2008, which, of course, you were a part of, and you guys were dominant. I mean, you outscored teams by 184 runs. You were 33 games over, and it just didn't work out in the playoffs. And I know the guys aren't going to ask you for advice, but what would you tell them as far as, hey, you're going in as the favorite and you're expected to, you know, go to the World Series? What would be your advice?
Yeah, I think just embrace the moment. Just live in the moment and not think about the next round or the World Series and all that's encompassing with that. I think just living in the moment and being present. Enjoy that day. Come to the ballpark that day and just focus on that. And I think that this team does as good a job as any team I've ever been around. They don't care about Cincinnati this weekend or who they're playing in the first round or the possibilities of going to World Series. Do they want to do that? Yeah, of course, they know the goal, but they are really focused about trying to win a game today in Pittsburgh, and that's all that matters to them. And they really, really emphasize that. They exude that when you're around them. That's all they talk about is just winning today. And I think, you know, just continue that process, you know, breathe a little bit because things speed up in the playoffs. But there's so much experience on that team with guys who've been to World Series, guys who've won World Series, the team last year getting to the NLCS and being a part of all that. So I think, you know, they're doing everything the right way and they'll be prepared. They're excited for this and they're going to be really ready once that bell rings and it's ready to go come game one.
And plus, our bench is so great, too. When your bench, I think they said at a combined on-base percentage of over 400, when you have Caesar, Listella, Elmora Jr., these are good problems to have.
Yeah, absolutely. When you're sitting there figuring out, how am I going to get this guy in the lineup? And, you know, a lot of times on some teams, when you get rid of guys or somebody gets hurt or a guy isn't performing, teams struggle to find a replacement, somebody who can step in. And when you have a guy like Javi Baez who can play Gold Glove defense at three different positions, plus swing the bat, and you have, you know, the options in the outfield of starting Chris Bryant in left field if you want. You have Jorge Soler. You have Chris Coghlan. You have these guys who can go out there and play in the outfield. You have guys who can play all over the diamond. You got three catchers you are capable of starting. So depth is incredible, but, you know, it's just a part of the puzzle, and it's something that we have the luxury of having a lot of, and that bodes very well, especially come, you know, this time of year into the postseason.
Have you ever been part of a battery with the manager coming out to the mound to take out the catcher to give him a curtain call?
Never. One of the coolest moments I've ever had at a baseball field was watching that.
Wasn't that great?
Oh, my gosh. I teared up. I was crying in the stands. I'm sitting there watching. This is a great friend of mine. He's out there. His last home regular season game. You know, he's getting ready to retire, and this moment happens. And I told him after the game, I said, I only want to cry with you one more time, and that'll be at the very end of October. So
yeah,
let's just knock that off. I can't be a grown man crying at the stands at a baseball game like that.
Yeah, and if it's November 2nd,
yeah, we'll
okay
let that
too
slide, too. Yeah.
Crying hey strength, Tim.
Yeah. Hey, Ryan, thanks. We'll talk to you next week. Have a great week, buddy.
Absolutely, guys. You better tell Norm I said hello.
Yeah, we will. Norm McDonald coming up right after we check traffic with Mary.
Thanks, Deb.
Back to the Steve Cochran Show.
720 WGN.
8:52 in the morning, 720 WGN. A little chilly fall morning here in Chicago. Dave Ennett, Andrea Darlis, in for Steve Cochran. Steve's taking a few days off. Justin Kaufman will be our guest host tomorrow, and Steve is back on Monday. Our next guest, Dave, one of my favorite, I'm not just saying that because he's on hold, one of my favorite all-time ever cast members of Saturday Night Live, Norm McDonald, has a new book out based on a true story, a memoir, and joins us now. Good morning, Norm.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, good. Wait, thanks.
Steve golfing?
Yeah, of course. Where else do you think you would be?
Yeah. Well, we'll have plenty of fun with Adam, but yeah, it's a little, I mean, this guy golfs more than Barack Obama, you know, jeez.
Yes, he does.
No. Hey, I didn't know, Norm, that you were on Star Search. Talk about reliving our childhood here.
Oh, yeah, well, I was on a special edition of Star Search called Celebrity, not Celebrity Star Search. That would be insane, Celebrity Star Search. It was called International Star Search. So I am from Canada, and I represented Canada. And then I was up against this guy. His name was the Bushman, and he was from Liberia. And so he wore a tribal gown and a tribal hat, and all his jokes were about gazelles and, you know, the Serengeti. Anyways, it turned out he was from Seattle.
Oh.
Someone told me that later.
A lion bush man.
Yeah. But you can see the bush man on. He's on he's on YouTube if you want to look him up, and he's challenging me to a comedy off. But yeah, so I went on there. Bushman got 4 stars. I got 3/4 of a star, which I didn't even know if that was possible. But what happened was 3 guys gave me 1 star. I figured it out mathematically later in my room, drunk on scotch. Three guys gave me 1 star. 1 guy gave me 0 stars, and I'm pretty sure it was Robin Leach.
Robin Leach.
Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. Yeah. Robin Leach.
That one.
That's right.
And you said that.
One time I saw Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, and it was like, you see this boat coming around. It was like in Tortuga, you know? And Robin Leach goes, Tortuga, it has everything. Beautiful sunsets, incredible, beautiful women. Tortuga has everything. Everything but Tony Danza. And then Tony Danza came putting around on a boat.
Of course.
In a dinghy.
And so you described Ed McMahon standing and staring at you while you were kind of having a rough time on stage that night?
Yeah, that'll rattle. Yeah, that guy glaring at you.
Well, I mean,
you know, because, you know, all he does is laugh. Well, you know, that's what he's paid for, laughing at the top of his lungs.
Yes,
and everything, you know,
yes,
anyone says. So, yeah, I looked over at him. It wasn't going well, you know? And it was International Star Search, remember? So, you know, the muttering in the crowd had a foreign tongue to it, you know? And I looked over at the only other English-speaking person in the room, old Ed McMahon. Yeah, he was shooting daggers at me.
Now, you also tell the story.
I don't mean looking at me in an odd way. I mean, he was throwing actual daggers.
Is that right? See, I met him a few times. I always thought he was a very nice man. I can't imagine him doing that. But you tell a story in there. Is this true, Norm, that there was a booker from The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, saw you perform offered you a gig, you thought the whole thing was just a put on and that you didn't take it seriously, and he really was from Carson and they wanted you on the show?
No, that part's not true. That part's based on a true story.
That's the title of the book, Dave. What's
exactly.
Oh, based on a true story, okay.
I wanted to be the last guest on the Tonight Show because Johnny Carson had already announced his retirement in 6 months. I said I'm going to be the last new comic, and Johnny will call me over to the couch and anoint me as a big star. You know, so that was my plan. I moved to Los Angeles and I did as many sets as I could. And then this guy, he came to see me. Then the first time he comes up to me after, he goes, I didn't like you, but then again, I'm really drunk.
We're talking to the incredible.
I see him, I'm doing my stand up, and I look over, and he's like in the third row, like necking with a girl. I'm like, oh god.
We're talking to the incredibly talented Norm MacDonald. This hour sponsored by the Wintrust Community Banks Hour. We thank them for that. Norm MacDonald, based on a true story, a memoir. One of my favorite parts of the book, Norm, is when you talk about auditioning for Lorne Michaels. And we see him every now and again making the cameo on SNL. We know him as this kind of ubiquitous but untouchable star, Hollywood legend. What was that like? Was that completely, were you just completely shaking in your shorts auditioning for Lorne Michaels?
Well, the way it happened with me, like, I was working at the time, my first job was... for Dennis Miller, then I got a job on the Roseanne program, you know, her sitcom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a guy from Saturday Night Live called me and offered me the job on Saturday Night Live. So I was real happy, and I had to go to Roseanne and allow her to let me out and all this. And then I moved to New York, and then I got to New York, and they said, you got to meet Lauren tomorrow morning. I'm like, oh, what's that all about? And they're like, that's the job interview. And I'm like, what? Oh. Like, I already moved here. Like, I quit my job and moved here because, this other guy told me I had the job. They're like, oh, no, only Lauren can hire you. So then I got really drunk, which was not a great move, you know. And the next morning I was so hungover and thirsty that I didn't even hear anything he was saying. I was just staring at a big, giant bottle of water, like, on his desk. Uh-huh. And I'm like, Lauren, can I have a drink of that water? And he's like, yeah. And you ever do that where you chug the entire thing of water? Like, your throat is so parched, you could, and you're like, oh, my God, I could drop kick a nun for a drink of Coke right now, you know?
Dave, you've had that experience.
No, never.
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 Hey, Norm, I'm looking at your Twitter here, and I'm wondering, speaking of alcohol, if you actually mean this. When I meet someone on a train, which I'm often on, and we're both strangers, that's when I can get down to the truth, ugly, and beautiful. Do you share more with people on a train than the people close to you?
Yes, if I'm traveling and that person's a stranger and I'm a stranger, then I just talk, I just say whatever I want because the person's not going to judge me. Yeah, he doesn't care. He can tell me his secrets. I'll tell him mine. As long as he doesn't recognize me, you know. Before I was famous, it was much better. I should say I travel on the train a lot. Sort of. I don't drive a car, but I like being in transit. So I take train rides every few days.
It's very Hitchcockian. Norm, thank you.
Do you like trains?
Not really, but I like the fact that you do.
I do.
Yeah. Hey, I never meet a guy and then plan to double cross murders with the guy or anything like that.
You never know when you run into Farley Granger.
Farley Granger.
Hey, thank you, Norm. You are the best. Get the book, Norm MacDonald, based on a true story, a memoir. As Steve says, get two. You're careless. You'll lose one. Hey, thanks, Norm, for being with us.
All right, guys. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
All right, sounds good. We'll give Steve...
Norm stand the lie.
There he goes.
There he go.
There he goes. How about my Farley Granger reference? It's pretty good.
That was pretty good.
Circa 1972.
Yeah, no kidding. You just dated yourself.
I did, right? We'll be back with the news after this. 720 WGN.
Live from the Allstate Showcase Studio, this is the Steve Cochran Show on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
9:13 in the morning, 720 WGN. Steve Cochran Show, Dave and Andrea Darlis here with you. Another 45 minutes or so, manning the ship. Steve is back on Monday. And Dave, you and I are extremely excited, and Mark Carmen, to have in studio with us now the legendary Tommy Lasorda, former LA Dodger manager and Olympian as well. Tommy's going to be speaking tonight at this wonderful program at the National Hellenic Museum in Greektown, right off of Halsted and Jackson. Program begins at 6 o'clock tonight. Admission is just $60, $45 for members. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to meet and talk with Tommy Lasorda.
Along with our friend Lou Kanellis. Tommy Lasorda managed the Dodgers for 20 years, 8 division titles, 4 pennants, 2 World Series championships. He was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1997, and he just celebrated a birthday last week. Tommy, welcome. Happy birthday to
you. Hey, thank you. Well, I always enjoy coming to Chicago. For some reason, I always loved this city. And I'm sitting here today because I'm doing to do a speaking engagement for a group here. But Chicago is a great city. I love it here.
Tommy, how much are you traveling these days? I mean, you're here, obviously.
Well, last week I traveled to New York, and then I went down where we go?
Louisiana. Yeah.
We spent about 5 days, 6 days in Louisiana, and then come back home.
By the way, they gave you for your birthday this adorable, it's beautiful. It's an LA Dodger themed blazer for your birthday, custom blazer that was designed just for you.
Yes,
that's
pretty,
something special.
Very nice.
Something very special.
Yeah.
You going to wear that?
I got a jacket that I'm going to wear tonight. That you and look on the inside, it's got my age,
yeah,
how many years I've been with the Dodgers, and everything. So, but it's on the inside.
So you'd have to take it off for people to see it.
So I walk down like this so people can see it.
What do you think of the Cubs?
Well, I think they've done a tremendous job. They were very patient in building. And that's what you see there, that what they build. They didn't have a good club at a few years back, but they come up with an outstanding team now. And it's an exciting team. It's not just a team that wins. It's an exciting team. And that's the way I was with my team for so many years. We would win because we had a lot of togetherness, a lot of spirit, a lot of willingness. And that's what you need to do to have a winning team.
But the thing you had such a strong organization. You always had young players. Not that you didn't acquire players via trade and whatnot, but you had strong young players coming up within the organization.
Absolutely right. When I managed the Dodgers for the first time, out of the 25 guys, 17 of them played for me in the minor leagues. So that just goes to show you, you can develop players for the major leagues, or you can sign players, free agents, and you can do a lot of different things today to get a winning team. I've seen so many teams so far that finished last and come back the next year and won.
Mm-hmm.
So the opportunity to win's better than it was then. When I was the manager, we had a tough time because we had to battle Cincinnati. We had to battle the Giants with Willie Mays. We had to the Phillies. We had to really battle the clubs. I know one time we went into Chicago in New York. And, it was in Cincinnati. I went there on the weekend, and so I said, I better go to Mass, you know, when you're going to play the Reds, you're going to have a tough time. So maybe I was looking for some help. So I went to church, but who came in and sat right next to me was Johnny McNamara of the Cincinnati Reds. Now, I look at him, I knew why he was there. And, of course, he looked at me while I was there. So at the conclusion of the mass, he and I walked out the center aisle together because he was going to give me a lift back to the hotel. When he veered off to the right, he said, "I'll meet you outside." I said, "No, where's he going?" The mass was ended. And I looked in there, and he was lighting a candle. So instead of me going out the door, I went over to the left side of the church and went down when he left, and I blew the candle out. And I kept hollering all throughout the game, "Hey, Mac, it ain't going to work, pal. I blew it out."
Joe Madden here with the Cubs has some rather unorthodox methods. He'll bring in a magician to entertain the players before a game.
Zoo animals.
They'll dress up when they go on road trips. All these kind of things that aren't necessarily traditional.
Well, that's good.
I like that stuff?
Yeah, sure. I did that. I had movie stars coming in.
Oh, sure.
They would come in, and when we played the Phillies in the playoffs, I had Rickles come in, and Larry Boa popped off after the game and said, "Yeah, Lasorda had to bring in Rickles." I said, "Hey, Rickles didn't play. All he did was have fun." That's what I wanted my guys to be loose, to get into the game. But I had all those movie stars would come to my office and sit down, and it was great. I miss it very, very much because I would have still been managing if my heart didn't give out on me. Yeah. So the doctor said, "You can't do it." He said, "You can't go down there because if you go down there the way you react, it's trouble."
Do you still at most of the games?
Oh, yeah. I'm still working for the Dodgers.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And he said he can't travel and all. I'm traveling more now than I did when I was managing.
We're going to take a break. Tommy Lasorda is with us. We'll bring Mark Carmen in here in a moment. Again, Tommy appearing tonight, a program at the National Hellenic Museum. Olympic spirit, the legendary Tommy Lasorda. We'll take a break. This is 720 WGN.
23 in the morning, 720 WGN. We're honored to have the legendary Tommy Lasorda in studio with us this morning. He's going to be at the Hellenic Museum in Greektown tonight for a one-on-one. You can meet Tommy, get an autograph. $60 admission. Well worth the price to meet Tommy Lasorda. So you were you managed the 2000 Olympic baseball team in Sydney, Australia.
Right.
Gold medalist. Now you can add to your accolades.
Right.
What was that like?
It was the greatest thing that happened to me because, you know, nobody could beat the Cubans. And I said, "Let me coach that team. We'll beat the Cubans. We got a better players than the Cubans." And I got the job, and, of course, we did beat the Cubans for the title of the Inc. because they gave me 24 players that I'd never seen before. So what I had to do was build up a relationship with them and make them believe that they're going to win this thing. And I told them that we didn't come, our theme was we didn't come 3,000 miles to lose.
Right.
Right.
And by golly, they won it. And I was so proud of them.
It was a wonderful moment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, speaking of wonderful moments, I thought this past weekend, the Dodgers did a wonderful job in honoring Vin Scully. And of course, your career and Vin's were intertwined.
And
I mean, he's everybody's favorite broadcaster. The Dodger fans were really lucky to have him there. What stands out to you, Tommy? Is there a favorite story or a favorite memory for you of Vin Scully?
Well, I was with him all these years. I never saw the guy mad. I never saw him turn anybody down for an autograph. Never saw him turn anybody down for a picture. He's just a great guy, and loved what he was doing and became one of the greatest announcers in the history of the United States. And I was so proud to be associated with him. I thought, by golly, this guy is so good. In fact, you know, even now, I would turn the other program on and so I could just listen to him with the game. And he was the great announcer, and he always brought a lot of knowledge to the about the players that were coming in there to play. So we'll never see another Vince Scully. So that's the way it's going to be.
Yeah.
But I told him, I said, I'm going to outwork you.
That's right.
He quit. I'm still working. I'm still working. And I'm going to work till I'm 100 years old.
God bless
and
you.
And I've got, let's see, I got about 11, 12 years to go. Mm-hmm. But I'm gonna live those 12 years. See, because God doesn't know where I am. I travel all the time. I know he's looking for me, but he can't find me.
Mm-hmm.
So by traveling so much, I still enjoy what I do. I go to all our minor league teams, talk to the youngsters, tell them what it's going to take to make it, and how to conduct themselves, how to represent the organization in the town that they're playing in. So I enjoy doing that, and I enjoy life. And I know he's looking for me, but he can't find me.
Hey, Tommy, speaking of those youngsters, there's a big talk in the game now, bat flips and celebrating the game, what's appropriate, what's not. I think a lot of people love you because you showed so much enthusiasm for the game. What do you tell young guys about, you know, what's appropriate as far as enjoying hitting a home run versus, you know, just putting your head down and running around the bases?
Well, that's the thing. You don't want to be you don't want to embarrass yourself. That's the main thing. And I had a bunch of guys that loved to play together. I convinced them that when you all get on one end of a rope and pull together, you can do a lot of things that you couldn't do otherwise. And so, you know, I managed for 20 years, and I had they stopped me because I had a bad heart. And here I am. I'm still around, and my heart's the same as it was then. But I'm traveling more now than I did when I was the manager.
That's right.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And God still can't find you.
He doesn't know where I am.
Right. Well, you will be tonight at the National Hellenic Museum.
Don't tell everybody about that.
I know, sir.
Hey, so do you think we're going to see a Cubs-Dodgers National League Championship Series?
It could easily be. Could, mm-hmm. Yeah, it could easily be. I keep saying, you know something? We haven't won a World Series. We haven't been in the World Series in 28 years.
28?
28. We're going on.
We're in Chicago,
we're past
Tommy.
108.
108 years.
Well, listen. Then you feel a lot worse than I do.
We do.
Tommy,
you look great.
Thank you for being here. We love you. Best of luck and keep moving.
Okay, you guys. Thank you. I love the city and I love coming here. I enjoy it. They're very, very good baseball fans, and if we don't win, I wish they will.
Thank you, Tommy.
Fair enough.
You
and again tonight with our buddy Lou Kanellis at the Hellenic Museum, 6 to 8 p.m.
Thank you, Tommy. We'll see you soon. Back after this on GN.
Live from the Allstate Showcase Studio. This is the Steve Cochran Show on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Hell yeah! It gets me grinning from ear to ear. Not just every now and then. I'm talking 365 days a year. I can do it around the clock. I don't like it just a little hoo. I like it a lot, even hot. Hell yeah, I like beer.
9:42 in the morning, 720 WGN. From baseball to beer. The original Craft Brew Festival that started right here in Chicago is back. The Beer Hoptacular was at the Aragon last year, Dave. This year it's at Cinespace Studios. Coming up in just over a month. We're excited.
Wait a minute. We have to wait another month?
I know. Saturday, November 5th. Two sessions, noon to 4 and 6 to 10. If you've never been to the Beer Hoptacular, I highly recommend it. I highly suggest you go. It's one of the funnest events of the year. Josh Sego, the president of Lou Dog Events, is the producer of Beer Hoptacular. And John Barley, the president and founder of Solemn Oath Brewery, both in studio with us. All right, is that your real name, John?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
I like to say
John Barley.
I like to say this industry chose me.
I bet it did. Yeah. All right, so tell us about the Beer Hoptacular.
Josh, go ahead.
Yeah, we're going into the 6th annual Beer Hoptacular, Chicago's original craft beer fest, taking place at Cinespace Studios. It's going to feature over 75 brewers, 150 beers, a DJ spinning all vinyl, food trucks, just an incredible festival taking place at an incredible space.
And the best part, a portion of the proceeds go to charity.
Yes, yes. We're partnering with Ignite the Spirit. It's a Chicago firefighters charity, and a portion of the proceeds will benefit them.
You can't beat that.
All right, so even though the name is the Beer Hoptacular, does that mean that it's going to be primarily really hoppy beers?
Yes and no. So with it, we try to stay true to the theme, and we do have some hoppy beers there. So definitely those hop heads are going to be available. Those beers are going to be available.
Hop heads.
Hey, it's not a bad nickname to have.
That's a good nickname. That's a band Steve was in.
That's right, the hop heads.
But beers do change with the season. So we're coming off the summer months, and everyone's used to the summer beers, and we're going into winter and fall. So we're going to have a lot of fall beers, some stouts, some porters, some barley wines, some brown ales. So it'll definitely reflect the season that we're in.
The pumpkin ales are really big right now, too. Everything's pumpkin, but the pumpkin beer is so good.
Yes, so we'll have some pumpkin beers there. We might even have a few Oktoberfest beers.
It's true, though, that to be a cool person now, you have to drink like an upper-level beer. And I mean, I'm trying to up-level my coolness. So
I think it's a law.
Right, exactly. So how would you direct somebody who perhaps doesn't know what they're doing? You should try this. This will make you, you know, just that much more people will want to be around you.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, be open to trying new experiences. Don't block something out just because you think you have some sort of mentality against it. But, everybody finds beers that they like in areas that they wouldn't like, and you might like stouts and not realize it. You might, if you're a wine drinker, you might like sour or wild beer that's kind of all the rage right now. So
I like the ciders. I'm more of a wine drinker, but sure. I love the ciders, and I found one last year. I think it might have even won. It was like a cinnamon horchata. It was a delicious beer. Delicious. And then there was another. I like how they had the different spices. There was a cinnamon curry beer, too, which was out of this world.
Is it kind of anything goes now?
Oh, I think absolutely. The brewers are getting more and more creative, kind of pushing the limits. It's not the traditional ingredients. There's lots of, innovation and creativity going into it. It's a artisanal craft.
Yeah, I mean, one of the beers that we're going to be bringing to this, this event in particular is interesting just because, this is one, there are a lot of different beer events that happen even around Chicagoland, and this is one where a lot of the brewers here, the community here in Chicago and Chicagoland is one of the most vibrant in the country from a craft beer perspective.
150 beers from more than 75 craft breweries from around the country. Mm-hmm. Certainly there's something for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, one beer that we're bringing that's particularly unique is called Rath. It's aged 6 months, a Belgian pale ale aged 6 months in a blend of American oak, Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc barrels with cherries, a little bit of a tart mouthfeel. Just a little bit interesting. Everybody's kind of bringing their A game for this event.
What do you say to the person that says, I just like Bud Light. I'm into Miller Light. That's me. What do you tell that person?
Wait, let me pick
how
up
do you
off
help
the floor.
Them?
Hold on.
This community, this particular here in Chicagoland, we make some killer pilsners as well.
Chicago's a great town, and I'm not just saying this, right, though, for craft beer.
Yeah, it's a beer town. It's a food town. Everybody takes a lot of pride in what they're consuming on that level and the experiences around it, and it's a very social town. We're very fortunate.
What's our position on the national craft beer scale? I mean, is Chicago seen as a real hotbed of it?
We're definitely in the top tier. I mean, I'd say the top three or four. I know there was a report that came out not too long ago from Cranes where we have the most square footage of brewery space in the country. So we're definitely, and we're continuing to grow. So we're a hotbed right now for craft beer.
We are. I think in the South Loop, they just opened at least two new breweries. So they're in all the neighborhoods. It's mm-hmm. not just downtown or Streeterville. It's all over the city.
Yep, absolutely.
But is that tough for like the new guy who wants to get into it and try to get a foothold? I mean, it's such a, is it too saturated now, the marketplace?
No, I mean, even with what it seems like is a lot of saturation, we're still at about 10% threshold for craft beer. So there's still a lot of room to be made up. There's still a lot of growth. If all the brewers that existed right now, as many as it feels like there are, grew by 400%, we'd be catching up with other parts of the country.
What would be the requisite skills to jump into that game if you were thinking about making a career change, just hypothetically?
Listen to him.
Yeah.
I got
a money notion over here.
I always got my mind.
Can you finish the shift before you do? Yeah.
Eyes are open, Dave. I got to see. We got opportunity right in front of us right now. See, you just said 10% of the market. I'm feeling a 90% at the Carm Beer. You can follow me on Twitter. What do we got here? What do I need to learn?
You know, just embed yourself in the industry, and for lack of a better term, I don't mean to push this, but drink a lot, right? But cool. Experience what you're about. But, you know, I had I founded a brewery. I had no home brewing experience. I had a passion for beer. My parents lived in Belgium, and a lot of my experience came from my passion for beer came from drinking Belgian beer in Belgium. And, you know, I have no business running a brewery, but here I am, and I love it.
See?
And doing it well.
Yeah.
Very well, absolutely. No, you joke, but I mean, you're a big foodie too, Mark. I mean, we like to try. I've seen just it get increasingly more popular. Mm-hmm. The pairings are so important now, right? So what would you serve, say, with fish? Would that be a hoppier beer or a lighter beer?
Yeah, it depends on how fatty and acidic and all that will kind of play out in some way. Something hop-focused will kind of cut into those fats pretty well as well.
Meat? Steak? What would you do? A darker beer?
You know, there's a time and place for everything, I would say. You know,
Dave?
A lot of it's personal preference.
Yeah, no, I'm good with either.
Either all or all of the above. Well, hold on. Keep talking with us. We're going to take a quick break here. We're talking about the Beer Hoptacular with the producer of the event, Josh Segoe, and John Barley, the president and founder of Solemn Oath Brewery. Talking beer on 720 WGN.
I'm no good slapping on paint. Don't have a knack for making motors crank, no. But I'm pretty good at drinking beer.
9:53 in the morning.
So hand me one more. That's what I'm here for. I'm built for having a ball.
Talking beer here on the Steve Cochran Show. Beer Hoptacular at CineSpace Studios, Chicago's original craft beer festival. It's Saturday, November 5th. Two sessions this year. It's moved from the Aragon to CineSpace Studios. It's gotten so big. 150 beers from more than 75 craft breweries from around the country. And Josh and John from the Beer Hoptacular are here. We were talking during the break about beer cocktails, meaning that you're mixing it with different ciders now. So it's not just a straight beer. You can mix it and create a different kind of libation, which is kind of neat.
Yeah, absolutely. It's become more and more popular. Beers being mixed with everything from scotch to bourbon, different juices, bitters, to create, you know, cocktails. We have a scotch company that's going to be at Beer Hoptacular mixing up some cocktails, and they'll do things like the scotch with two parts grapefruit juice, lemon bitters, and then mixing it with IPA and creating a totally new concoction.
How about that? Wow. You just got another pair of tickets sold here. Sandberg, our producer, is a big scotch fan. The scotch tasting is fantastic.
She's in. A lot of grapefruit juice being used in beer, like some of the, I want to say Stiegel, they make a grapefruit beer.
Rattler.
Rattler, yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of that as well is also perception, your brain perceiving, say, a hop profile that's actually making you think and relate it to grapefruit as well.
Oh, okay. It's tricky.
Listen to you. You're combining two of your favorite things, healthy eating and beer, right? Grapefruit and beer.
Yeah, I suppose.
Some of the tasting. Hey, speaking of tasting, all right, I know there's this whole art to tasting wine where you let it breathe and you swirl mm-hmm. and then you sniff. Is that the same with beer?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. You know, letting it warm up a little bit is going to let some of the flavors, some of the aromas come out. But yeah, absolutely. Oxidizing a little bit and getting your nose in there, just similar to wine. If you kind of mimic that that process, you're gonna learn a lot about your beer as well.
And it is true that like a true diehard beer guy would rather drink a beer out of a can than a bottle, correct? Because there's less air. Is that right?
The can plus on that side is more of the packaging side of it. Sunlight will go into a bottle and can change some things. The perfect canister being a can, you know, there's no oxygen in there. There's no light destroying the beer and killing it in some way. That's why you're also seeing a huge revolution with cans right now, which we're also a part of.
Yeah. Mark has a lot of experience in the industry.
I do.
He used to sell beer.
That's true. Many years I cracked open Bud and Bud Lights, Miller Lite, Miller Draft. Never upper level. But now they got the goose is loose out of Wrigley. They got Goose Island. So I guess that's a move.
You're used to be calling Beer Man. Hey, Beer Man. That's why you want to venture out.
I've got style. You've got style. Who needs an old style? It's one of my famous sayings, Andrea.
You coined that phrase?
I did.
Really?
I was big.
Well, for more information, go to beerhoptacular.com. Again, tickets are $50, well worth the price. Two sessions on Saturday, November 5th at CineSpace Studios on the west side.
And again, benefiting the Ignite the Spirit Fund, which helps support Chicago Fire Fire Department, helping ease the hardship of families of firefighters in need. So great cause. Guys, thanks for being here.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you both. We're back after this on WGN.